This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November 16th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. We're about a week away from Thanksgiving, and then it's prime time for the holiday season, whatever that's going to look like this year. I imagine a lot of us are getting solicitations from not-for-profits and other initiatives that try to address hunger. And this is definitely a food-based season, and it's a good time to remind folks that many people in our own communities can't consistently afford nutritious food, or they don't have regular access to a place that will sell them nutritious food. And there are many, many organizations and government entities that serve low-income people in central Indiana and help them obtain food. But there are still many, many people who still slip through the cracks of this patchwork system. And in the economic downturn brought by the pandemic, many more people are now struggling to feed themselves and their families. Now, imagine this. What if all the food relief organizations and programs were guided by an overarching and comprehensive strategy? And the Indianapolis area's corporate community, which so often in the past has come together to solve big problems, provided resources to drive the strategy and help cover everyone who needs food year-round. Sounds pretty good to me. Now, could they make this effort sustainable over the foreseeable future? And in essence, really, the question is it possible to effectively cure hunger in Marion County? Now, this is probably a little too simplistic, but if you want to just think about it in terms of providing meals to people, we would need to provide at least 750,000 more meals per month. Now, in terms of the process, maybe the operative question is, how could you persuade all of these players who have worked hard to carve out their own places in the hunger relief community to become part of a bigger effort? Well, you may have guessed where this is going. We're about to find out. A broad coalition of corporate, not-for-profit, and government organizations is launching an incredibly ambitious food relief and sustainability program for Marion County. It's called Food Secure Indy. The goal is to maximize current efforts and connect them in a way that hasn't been done before, and within a few years, ensure that no one in Marion County goes hungry. To address all of our questions, I've invited to the podcast this week Margie Kraft. She's a senior advisor for Elanco Animal Health, headquartered in Greenfield, and really the prime corporate mover in food security. Margie serves as the project lead for the initiative. Here's our conversation. I'm pleased to welcome to the IBJ Podcast Virtual Studio, Margie Kraft, a senior advisor for Elanco Animal Health and the project lead for Food Secure Indy. Margie, thank you for making time today.
Thanks for having me, Mason. I'm excited to be here to talk about the project.
So Food Secure Indy is a very ambitious initiative. So let's just start with the elevator pitch. Try not to go over 30 seconds. I just ran into you in the hallway. What is Food Secure Indy?
Food Secure Indy is the goal of over the next 2 to 3 years, so by 2023, of securing enough nutritious meals to meet the needs and to have clear and optimized path to resources for all of our citizens in Indianapolis, and to have a sustained and trusted partnership and working collaboration between our public, private, and nonprofit entities.
So I think people will first go, oh, food security, this is yet another not-for-profit that's devoted to food relief. Is that the case?
No, but I get how people would think that. So it is not another non-for-profit. This is really trying to bring all of our areas together who are working in this space so that we all understand what's in the playbook. There's a lot of good energy and efforts and resources available today. It's just how do we connect them to maximize them to the best of our ability and let the experts in each of those areas continue to be the experts in those areas.
We have all of these, I mean, a universe really of of food relief organizations that serve Indianapolis. I mean, we have Gleaners, we have Second Helpings, we have the Midwest Indiana Food Bank or something like that.
Yeah, Midwest Food Bank.
There's a food bank, thank you. Mm-hmm. We have federal
nutrition assistance. We have state programs. Our schools provide food for students. So what I'm getting is we're going to try, or Food Secure India is going to try to connect all of these and help them collaborate to meet one goal, which is to get rid of hunger.
Correct. So easy task, right?
Why didn't somebody think of this before? It sounds so easy.
I know. So what we know about all the things that you've just spelled out is really this asset approach that we're taking with this initiative, and that there are all of those assistance and resources and programs available for our citizens. But what we also know is that 17% of all of the food resources out there come from non-government supported programs. So that's your Gleaners in Midwest, while they participate in some of those programs. So that's a small portion of the overall picture. And so that's why connecting that work with what our public entities, whether it's the state or the city, and even our federal programs, that's why connecting it with that big 83% of the work is really important. And so that when policies and decisions are made, that we truly do understand the waterfall impact of those decisions and how can that 17% maximize the other area and vice versa. It's an attempt to really bring all of those elements together, but adding in the private component, because we know that food insecurity or hungry individuals have a negative business implication across the board for our city. Our city cannot thrive if all of our citizens don't thrive. And so for our private entities, it's how do we fund appropriately? How do we support and bring the right causes to the light of our local city government or our state legislators, that we ensure that the right emphasis on this food insecurity issue in our city and state is appropriately managed?
When you say private, are you talking about the members of the corporate community?
The corporate community, yes. Yeah, we call ourselves the private community, but it's not so private because we are big corporations in the city that call Indianapolis our home. And so the corporations have a vested interest in having our citizens be healthy and thriving.
And you are, as I mentioned at the beginning, I mean, you are employed by Elanco Animal Health, which is, I think, one of our newest public companies that just spun off from Eli Lilly and Company, which... which may be our largest public company. First, tell us what Elanco Animal Health is.
You spoke to it a little bit. So Elanco was formerly the animal health division of Eli Lilly. And a little Jeopardy quiz for you. Elanco actually stands for Eli Lilly and Company. That's how the spelling came to be. And so we spun out on our own as an independent animal health company and the newest public company for the state of Indiana, which we're very excited about. And Elanco manufactures and sells products for our, what we call farm animals. So pigs, chickens, and cows, that's both dairy and beef cattle. And we also have our pet health team and section of the business, which is focused on dogs and cats. And so when you think about well-being for those animals, those are the products that we manufacture. And our vision at Elanco is food and companionship enriching life. And so how we came to be the sort of lead in this initiative is Jeff Simmons, our CEO, has been a huge proponent and passionate about food security for almost his entire career and has several stories that have impacted him personally that make him connected to this. And with our vision as a company, we really saw this in the summer as an opportunity to take advantage of the environment in which we are living in, which is COVID has created a space where change is more acceptable because we've been forced into it, right? So in the food security space, we've had some incremental changes and incremental improvements, but COVID really highlighted the need to make big leaps and bounds in this space. So we wanted to take advantage of that. We also recognize that we are very fortunate in this time that we've got a great mayor in the city of Indianapolis who happens to be a Democrat, and we just reelected our Republican governor, Holcomb, who have a very good working relationship, and they both value and see the importance of solving this food insecurity. So while we have that really strong government connection and partnership, even if they are on different party lines, that's an opportunity for us. And then, of course, with the social injustice environment, we know that people of color are disproportionately impacted by food insecurity, among other things. And so all of those scenarios together, with the passion that Jeff and Alenko has around food security, we said, you know, the time is right to make that big leapfrog change versus the incremental change. And Jeff, and this is the power of CEOs and corporations, where the connections are strong and you can pick up the phone and say, I think this is something we need to do. And without any hesitation, those who are part of our steering committee and our tier one working group said, we're all in and let's do it. So that's how Alenko became to be the lead of what we're calling this phase one work. But again, this is going to take a couple of years to accomplish. And so it really is a partnership versus an Alenko project.
All right, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Creek DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Creek DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Creek DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.creekdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. Our guest this week is Margie Kraft, project lead for Food Secure Indy, and she's explaining how this ambitious effort to end hunger in Marion County will work.
So phase one is what?
So phase one is really, since we are taking this asset-minded approach and realizing how much work is already happening in this space, much of which you mentioned, is really to do an evaluation, an asset evaluation, a landscape review of all of the work that is currently happening today, the big work in the city. And so that's step one, is collecting all of that in a shared repository of work for all those involved in the project. And then looking at that and saying, okay, we understand that Gleaners is, you know, a food bank and they are providing food for those coming to their location, but also to food pantries in the state. We know that the city has got some proposals and recommendations out for how they hear from the community the needs that are happening. We know the governor had his task force on how to improve the food security efforts for the state level. So it's knowing what all of those are and then what area of food security do they impact. So we know there's four key areas that you have to address if you want to solve your food insecurity. One is food availability, so that's being able to produce it and get it to people. So you think of IHN and Gleaners in that space, and Midwest Food Bank, for example. The second one is around food access. So this is on the transportation need. How can they actually get to that food? Is there a marketplace in the community where they're able to go? What does that puzzle piece look like and who's working in that area? Then you have what's called food usage, which there's two components of that. One is food waste and the other is the dietary component. Are we meeting the nutritional needs in terms of the food usage? And then the last piece is really around stability, and those, that's where your policy, macroeconomic things happening come into play. So addressing each of those four areas is what's gonna get us to this end state of Food Secure Indy. And then right out of the gate, the phase one is going to emphasize closing the meal gap with nutritious meals, because we know a lot of the federal programs that were added in response to COVID will be ending at the end of December. They extended them beyond the summer. Some of this will be the school program, some protections for farmers. They are coming to an end at the end of the year. And so we know that that's on the horizon. So we're focusing this first landscape review where we can then connect the complementary work to really amplify and magnify its impact on closing the meal gap with nutritious meals. And then we move into the more sustainable piece of the puzzle, which is how do we get more into what our impacted persons experience and the programs, how they negatively or positively impact them, and what changes can we make for a sustainable long-term problem solving.
So it's not just sustainable in the sense of can we continue to provide X amount of support to make this work? But also, how can we help the people who experience hunger get out of that situation? How can we help them sustain themselves?
Correct. And I love that you highlighted those two areas, because I think there is some concern that, oh, look, we have really solved for food insecurity, and so they're fine now. We can go turn our attention somewhere else. And that's not the case. It's one of these situations where you have to continuously support it and continuously drive whatever changes and models that we have in place to ensure that we are able to provide it, but also in helping those impacted persons create a situation and an environment where they can continue to move to the on that path of sustainability for themselves and path to success.
I'm just go backwards just a little bit, talking about how you connect all of these pre-existing organizations. I'm going to go off on a tangent here real quick. Somebody who contributes to, a couple of these organizations, it's always in the back of my mind, it has always seemed just a little weird that, you know, I have to choose which organization I think is going to do the best job to take care of hungry people in my community. Although there's so many different organizations that basically, I mean, to me as the donor, it seemed like they're kind of doing the same thing. I mean, so I really like the idea that we can somehow, you know, coordinate what they're doing and potentially eliminate any overlap, for example. But mm-hmm. if you have so many like well-established organizations that are so used to doing things one way or doing things, you know, the other way, you know, to hopefully differentiate them from another kind of group. I mean, how on earth do you get them all on the same page and get them, I mean, I guess potentially to change what they do?
That is the million-dollar question. So what it really comes down to, or what I've isolated as the project lead initially with these groups, is they are experts at what they do, and they do it very well. And several of them do very similar work. Now, the community in which they serve is what really can be different, right? Or the types of individuals that they serve can be different. But the actual act of what they do looks and feels very similar, and in some cases, very much is. So when I look at, okay, we've got this group that really focuses here and another group that focuses in another area, how do we get them all on the same page? And the first thing is really around trust, because if I'm asking all the players to the table, which they've agreed to come, I'm also asking them to bring their playbook. I'm a big sports fan, so I will generally use sports analogies when I'm describing something. So I need the players to bring the playbooks to the table. But if you don't have well-established trust between these organizations, that can be problematic. And so part of what our steering committee and part of what this phase one, tier one working group is building this trust. And, okay, this is how I'm doing things. Are you going to make me change everything that I'm doing and what I'm doing is wrong? And the answer to that is no. We are trusting, again, what is driving in the North Star on this is this asset approach. You are an asset. What you do matters. And we can't change it because we have been able to solve, particularly during COVID, it was remarkable what the city came together to do, all these organizations came to do to solve the major gaps and issues that we had around food. We just need to continue that. So it's proven itself a little bit already. It's just how do we create that environment and trust among these organizations, individuals, city employees that we say we trust, we know that this is the end game. What is going to be really important, particularly for our nonprofits, but even for our public entities, is that the donors, much like yourself, if you're saying, I am contributing to these causes because I want to play a part in this, keep doing that. That's important. But they have a responsibility to fulfill the mission that they've told their donors. Right. So we are not here to say, change your mission entirely. It's if you are excellent at the food availability piece, and I'll use Midwest Food Bank, for example, if that is your role, let's keep that being your major role instead of you recognizing there's a gap around food utilization or food access and you're trying to create another segment of your business or model that addresses those two things. If we already have those being covered by different organizations who are really well equipped and manage to do that, we just need to build the bridge and the linkage between those. So we call that really, there's a bonding component within a certain space versus bridging. So we've got our, you know, if I'm using the four KPIs or key performance indicators of food security, one being the food availability, you have this list of individuals and organizations that work in this food availability piece. Indie Hunger Network is a perfect example. They work on bonding and bringing that group together regularly because they are doing this similar type of work. They share best practices. They help coordinated efforts throughout the city and the state. And that's super important. What we now want to move, and you have that within each group, right? Within food usage, stability, and food access. What we now need to do is bridge between each of those areas related to food security so that we have a more shared collaborative approach to solving it. So it's not changing missions. It's not telling donors, hey, I know I said this is what was happening with your funds, but we're really going to start doing this instead. It's going to make sure that what you do and contribute to is really working the best it possibly can, because we're going to allow them to be great at what they do.
And then we fold in the corporate side of this, the private side. Mm-hmm. And then what role, it'd be helpful to talk about some of the corporate community members that are involved, but then mm-hmm. how do they help make this go?
Partners who are involved, we have Corteva is the big partner. Food security is one of their major corporate goals as well. Anthem, while not a formal partner on the list, is very active in the food security space, so they're walking right alongside of us in this work. We've got Provincia, which is a newer company here in Indiana that is a tech-based prescription diet. I say prescription diet, it's a wraparound service company that helps people with specific dietary needs, but also other wraparound services once they have a diagnosis of some sort. So those are a few of our corporate private partners in this. We also have CICP, which is really bringing a lot of the corporate partnerships along with us, even though they fall in the nonprofit bucket. And of course, we're continuing conversations with others to have them come along. So that's just the list as it stands today, plus Elanco. The role of the private, I think, is really important because, again, when we think about how do we elevate food security, in this example, food security, to the level that gets the right attention when it comes to policy, when it comes to investment from the city or from the corporations themselves, they allow the business community really brings that sort of power in the message that perhaps if a nonprofit went in to try to get the same attention, it may not get it because they are smaller. That's the nature of the beast. It's not that what they do is wrong or what they've said is any different than what we would say. It's just the level of attention and appropriate funding that we can bring. And that's really the goal here. We want, just like for personal private donors, as we were just saying, to the organizations that matters that you want your money to go to work, we as the corporate world want to be able to fund sustainable things, right? It's not just, let me check the box and I gave money. I mean, corporate social responsibility has really changed. Elanco just announced our pledges for the next 10 years of how we intend to really support the environment, sustainability, and types of governance for our company and our commitment. We'll be soon announcing our equity goals. So it matters to corporations to be able to have transparency and clarity on significant impact that our dollars can make. And so we see a major outcome of this being that transparency in the sustainable programs and what they can fund and bringing those types of resources to play, but also in highlighting it to the right people and at the right level who can make change. So it's a bottom-up and a top-down approach.
So you show them the playbook and say, here's how, mm-hmm. here's how we're going to get all our players together. Here's how we're going to beat the Patriots.
Yes, let's do it. Take them down.
Right, exactly. And then they can help with whatever expertise they have, whatever financial assistance they could provide.
You know, ultimately, it would be so great if we could move to a real integrated funding approach versus kind of one-off campaigns where you're going back to the same well for the same type of things and it feels a little disjointed and isn't this what I just supported? But if we are able to have that, you know, big playbook and who's on first, we think we can achieve having a more integrated approach to corporate support versus one-off campaigns. And the other part of the resource you've already mentioned is people, talent, right? The analytic capability or the, you know, we've got Black Belts helping us, the Six Sigma Black Belts helping us on this project, but even just very in-depth experience in food security space as a whole that a lot of these companies have as a passion of their organization. So it's really also the talent piece that the corporations can bring that nonprofits specifically will not always have those resources available.
Do you have a staff or is this just you?
Mighty staff of one. Well, it's just me from the project lead standpoint, but we currently have about five black belt, Six Sigma black belts between Elanco, but also a couple from Corteva that are helping us out in this initial phase. But yeah, small but mighty, small but mighty.
What does eradicating hunger in Indianapolis look like from a meal perspective?
We know that the current meal gap, this was back in June. So this data may have changed as we move further into the year, that we have about a 750,000 meal gap in a given month.
But again, it's not simply, you know, a matter of, you know, putting 1,000 tables out on Monument Circle with 700,000 meals and saying, hey, come and get it. You need to be able to get the meals to particular populations, get them at the right time, get them consistently, and then figure out a way so that this effort is sustainable over the long term, and then also help the people you're helping help themselves.
Correct. Because you've also got to think about the communities in which they live. You got to think about the cultural impact of this, right? So just because I think butternut squash soup is delicious in this fall season does not mean that that is an important vegetable in some communities. So it has a lot to do with ensuring that what is provided is the right solution for that community, and that it's sustainable. So yes, that's why setting up your tables out on Monument Circle and inviting everyone, you'll close it for that day and that moment of time. But then you've got dinner, and then you've got the next day or the next week where someone's situation has changed, or guess what? That community still doesn't have a local marketplace, or there's no urban farming capability set up there, or even awareness about the government programs that people are eligible for. They just don't actually realize it, or their application process to be considered, they don't understand how to navigate and work it, because it's, you know, as some systems go, it may not always be the easiest and smoothest for every individual, particularly if English is their second language. So there's things like that that we have to take in consideration when we are able to claim. That's that clear and optimized path to resource piece of the goal that I mentioned before. That's really what that is hitting at, is the accessibility and stability piece of it.
Well, again, as I said, that sounds pretty easy. I don't know what the big deal.
I know, real easy. Nothing under the hood there, I promise.
Tell me, what are your goals here by the end of the year? What's the two or three things on your calendar that you consider the next steps in the journey?
Yep. So this is kind of the uncool part, unless you're a data guru, but it's really that asset review. So by the end of the year, our goal is to have all the major and maybe even mid-major efforts categorized and identified where we know where that complementary work is that we can ramp up starting the beginning of the year. So that's really this first stage. And I don't want to underestimate or emphasize the importance of building trust in this steering committee and our tier one working group, because for some of them, they've been working together for a long time and the collaboration is wonderful. And then for some, it's going to be very new. So I would say those are the tactically, you know, we've just got, let's understand our landscape and the assets that we have, but then more on the behavioral component of it is building the trust and knowing that we're all heading for something bigger than us, which is creating a food secure Indianapolis, which is pretty cool.
Well, bless you. I mean, it sounds like a fantastic idea, and I hope that this really works out.
Well, thank you.
My thanks again to Margie Kraft. If you'd like to learn more about Food Secure Indy, IBJ's John Russell took a wide angle view of hunger in central Indiana earlier this month, which you can find via the search function on the homepage of IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I do want to draw attention to several strong stories in the latest issue of IBJ. Across Indiana, the number of patients hospitalized with COVID-19 has been swelling like a flooding river, threatening to swamp stressed out staffs and raising alarms about the capacity of local healthcare systems. John Russell examines how hospitals are handling the COVID-19 surge as it threatens to become an onslaught. Also in this week's issue, we take a deep dive into Hamilton County which remained a Republican stronghold in an election many experts believe would show a tilt to the left and produce wins for Democrats. Lindsay Erdody reports that President Trump and a combination of developments specific to the year 2020 blocked any chances of a blue wave. And Susan Orr forecasts a chilly reception for Indigo when it reports to the Indiana legislature on its underwhelming efforts to raise private money to help fund a major expansion of the transit system. Again, you can find these stories in IBJ's latest print edition or online at IBJ.com. Of course, it's quite a bit easier to access IBJ's nearly bottomless trove of stories and vital statistics about Central Indiana's business, community, and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for authoritative and actionable information that you're not going to find anywhere else. And you can be sure that we're going to be all over the repercussions of the election and what it means for Central Indiana. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.